This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You've come to the right place. It's Pro Wrestling Love, episode number 20, and you know what that means. When the number is divisible by 5, we are in the top 5. We are in the cream of the crop, the elite of the elite of whatever we're listing. And in this case, we are listing the best Japanese wrestling matches take place between 2000 and 2009. I'm Marty Sleaze. We're on the Place to Be Nation. I'm on Twitter as Superstar Sleaze in the Pro Wrestling Only forums. I've been joined by Mike in all 5 of these episodes. Thank you, Mike, for joining me. He's the Who 5 on Pro Wrestling Only forums. You'll find out what we believe are the top 5 wrestling matches to take place in Japan between 2000 and 2009. As I've been talking about in the previous episodes, please join us at the GWEproject.freeforums.net. Greatest Wrestling Match Ever Project. Submit top 100 greatest wrestling matches, according to yourself, every SummerSlam. We compile the list. It's a great way to discuss and learn about new pro wrestling. My blog is ryanspacemountain.blogspot.com. Without any further ado, the top 5 best matches to take place in Japan between 2000 and 2009. Hope everybody enjoys. Episode number 20 on the Place to Be Nation, and we are concluding our countdown of the top 25 best matches to take place in Japan between the years of 2000 and 2009. That's right, it's the top 5, the cream of the crop, the elite of the elite. We're very excited. I'm here with the Who 5 from Pro Wrestling Only. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm really excited for these matches because these are still my favorite matches from the 2000s.
That's awesome. So actually, yeah, that's a question I have for you. So for the most part, I haven't watched these matches in a good 6-7 years. Obviously, my reviews are still valid. Love these matches. But how long has it been since you revisited these matches? Or did you rewatch?
I rewatched all of them within the last 2 weeks.
Awesome. I'm glad you did. So that's, I think that helps. So you still love these matches after rewatching them?
Oh, yeah, especially these. I would not argue with any of these picks.
Awesome. All right, so let's no further ado. We'll get to the top 5. We'll start with mine, and we'll work our way to number 1. We'll find out what the best match in Japanese wrestling in the 2000s was today. Okay, so my number 5. I don't think you've said it yet, so it could be a little bit higher on your list. I'd be surprised if it's not on your list. It's from New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's Toshiaki Kawada and Masafuchi versus Yuji Nagata and Takahashi Iizuka from December 14th, 2000.
I actually did say this one earlier.
You did?
Put it off until now.
Okay. What did you have it? What number did you have it at? I forgot.
I would have to go back and look. Okay. Yeah, it was mid-teens, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was somewhere in the teens.
To me, this is the best match of what I've been saying, one of my favorite genres, the two pricks versus the ace babyface and either a rookie young lion or a mid-card whipping boy. So in this case, Kawada and Fuchi, the All Japan Invaders, are the pricks. Nagata's your ace babyface, and Iizuka is that mid-card whipping boy.
I would argue with you on that because if you watch the match again, yep. Nagata's introduced first for his team.
Really?
Yeah, I was surprised too because I never noticed it the first time, and I always assumed Nagata was just like the guy back then, but he was considered under Iizuka at this point.
That's interesting because, I mean, Nagata, right, doesn't get his big win until 2001, so it is a little early for him, but see, Iizuka's a really interesting guy because he has this match and the match that we talked about in the last episode with Hashimoto. In the tag setting at the beginning of 2000. But before that, I mean, he's really only known in America for his 92 match with the Steiner brothers. That is that crazy match where the Steiners kind of are extra stiff with him.
Yeah.
But like, what else does he have? It's a very interesting career, you know, because you don't really hear about him before or after the year.
Yeah. 2000. I mean, maybe there's more there where he's just one of those kind of mid-card guys who moves up to the main event now and again and can hang with the main guys, but never seems to get to finish them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess, I mean, Kensuke Sasaki was definitely the ace of New Japan at this point, so maybe it doesn't quite fit my model. But I will say this, it is two pricks versus two valiant babyfaces, and it's great.
Oh, that's certainly true. And Kawada, being one of the pricks, still gets the chance like he would in All Japan.
I haven't seen in a while, so like I said, I'm kind of surprised by that. I didn't note that in my review, so Kawada was still pretty over.
Yeah, he was the most over guy out there by far.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, I think, you know, just kind of in my head, I always kind of thought of New Japan as WWF and All Japan as WCW. Like, All Japan obviously did well, ran the Budokan a bunch, eventually graduated to the Tokyo Dome in 98 and 99. But I always felt like New Japan must be more popular because they were running the Dome every year. But maybe the popularity gap wasn't that big.
Well, I don't know if that was it, or maybe they just did better business.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. Anyways, this is a big heated interpromotional match. To me, the point where it really becomes awesome and then they're just off to the races and the rest of the match is great is when Kawada is doing his patented like hamstring stretches and Nagata just kicks him right in the face.
I like that.
And you just know it's on at this point. Kawada retaliates with a kick to the face. And Fuchi, your boy Fuchi, was fucking awesome in this match. God, knee crusher on Azuka. He's so cocky. Such a great asshole lieutenant. And, you know, it's like Fuchi, he kind of was underrepresented in the mid-90s, late 90s, but boy, when he was called upon, he got right back into that early 90s mode where he was just a great cocky asshole. He does all
notes on the match. I have it that Fuchi is doing everything possible to get this crowd to boo him, and
yes,
he really is. Like from the start of the match, he's basically just stalling away and not engaging on purpose just to piss off the opposition in the crowd, and then he continues to do it while they're working over Izuka. He's just like, I'm just going to be as much a prick as humanly possible.
Yeah, I love the two spots that I really like from Fuchi is when he stands on Izuka's neck and legs, and then he follows that up by just standing on Izuka's head and taunting Nagata. That's great. And they he taunts Nagata so much that eventually it goads him in. Kawada is able to cut him off. And then, like, I just really love this part of Japanese wrestling where they've basically destroyed Izuka and now they're keeping him at bay and just brutalizing Nagata. And it's a total full court press on Nagata. And it's just been like, Kawada beat Sasaki a couple months ago. Like, shit looks really bleak for New Japan. And so
Sasaki is at ringside, like, agonizing over this.
Yes. He's exhorting Nagata, get up, come on, you can do this, you know? So you really get this feeling like it's do or die for the New Japan boys. Like, they really need this win. And so there's this great moment where Azuka finally gets the suplex and he gets a sleeper on Fuchi, and Fuchi's selling of the sleeper is so good. He collapses. Kawada knows that he's behind enemy lines at this point, really only has one ally. So he goes to check on Fuchi, which allows Azuka to tag out, and it's on. Nagata Kawada have just this awesome exchange. Wouldn't be out of place in 90s All Japan. They had been focusing on Azuka's knee, so Nagata goes after Kawada's knee, and Fuchi tries to save. Fuchi ends up in a leg submission. It's cooking in Greensboro, North Carolina, baby. My favorite part, and I think this is my favorite part of the whole match, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Fuchi's released from this, and so Fuchi's the illegal guy. He was trying to save Kawada. Kawada is legal. Fuchi's released, and he collapses in the corner looking for a tag. Like, it was so great. Like, he had his arm outstretched, like, tag me, but there's no one there, and he doesn't even need to tag out. And so it was such a great Fuchi
stuff. That's the kind of stuff that makes Fuchi awesome. Like, he'll do stuff. I mean, he'll do that kind of Tenryu thing where he's a complete dick, but then he'll sell things so well that you're like, man, that poor guy.
Yeah. he was great in this match. Kawada actually ends up having to tag him in a limping Fuchi. Fuchi ends up drop kicking Iizuka's knee, hoping to regain the advantage. So then they do the flip of the Greensboro double leg submission, is the double stretch plum. We get one last Kawada Nagata exchange that they just rip into each other with vicious face slaps. Nagata gets the cross arm breaker. And I just love this visual where Nagata gets the cross arm breaker and Fuchi's just standing on Nagata's head as the time limit expires. Great use of the time limit draw. It felt like a war, felt symmetrical. Fuchi was the MVP. Iizuka was just a great whipping boy, and Kawada and Nagata were aces to the extreme. So yeah. My favorite tag team match of the decade.
It was a damn good tag team match. It was one of my favorite. And yeah, I liked that. Yeah, the double submission spots, the dueling double submission spots, even where it first went the New Japan guys and the All Japan guys. I really liked that.
Yep.
And then, yeah, Iizuka and Fuchi had a really good head crack spot where, you know, like they're both running and or one of them's running, the guy turns around and they bang heads. Like they did a really good job with that on that one here. And like the thing I take from this is that if Nagata was introduced before Iizuka, this match was here to put him over in a huge way. Because he just stood up to Kawada, right?
Yep.
Like if Iizuka's the big guy on his team and Kawada's on the other team and they get a draw, that's a win for them.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, Iizuka and Nagata are sort of a step below Kawada. So for them to actually get a draw against Kawada's team is a big deal for them.
Yeah, and having Nagata do a bunch of the heavy lifting and Iizuka kind of be like the face in peril and then come in and just help, it's just like, okay, you're really trying to say something about Nagata with this match.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the way they presented Kawada Nagata made Nagata feel really big in the match.
And it was more a stylistic thing, I feel like, where it's like they didn't feel like Iizuka was really going to match up with Kawada real good. But at the same time, they had to be thinking, boy, if we can carry this off, we'll give him a ton of heat because he, you know what I mean? He just took on Kawada and he came out not beneath Kawada.
For sure. Yeah, I agree. It was really good booking. And I think it makes sense because Nagata ends up winning the G1 Climax the following year. So.
Yeah, so it's just like kind of a springboard for him to go off of like, hey, I didn't beat Kawada, but he didn't beat me either.
Right, where Sasaki, you know, did lose to Kawada. Obviously, Sasaki gets his win back on January 4th, but it was definitely a big deal. Anyway, so what's your number five, brother?
My number five would have been Misawa versus Takayama from April 15th of 01, which you already had on the list.
Right, I had a little bit back. Why don't you go ahead and go first, since you liked it a little bit more?
Yeah. I liked how they were really careful right away. Like, Misawa wasn't treating him like a pushover. He was really being careful not to just run into anything. Yep. And Misawa ends up getting him outside early, and he does the elbow suicida. But then he goes up top to do that diving elbow that he likes to do after that. And to your point earlier, Takayama does a little sidestep and hits a big knee to Misawa's face as he's diving at him. So,
yep.
And then Misawa just puts this over big. And then Takayama hits a baseball slide to the floor, backdrop onto the announce table, back suplex on the ramp, and he jump knees Misawa back into the ring. It's just this huge sequence, and you're like, wow, yeah, he's really taking it to Misawa. And Misawa is actually selling it, too. And then Takayama slows it down into a chin lock, and they go into throwing elbows at each other. They were going so good.
Yeah.
But they get it back, because Misawa, in completely not Misawa strategy, goes after the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And then he starts going for Takayama's arm. And he never works a limb. So when he does, that means that this guy is hurting him, and he doesn't want to take it anymore. Like he's putting the guy over by doing this. It's not him being weird. It's just like, I got to do something about this because it's starting to hurt.
Good. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't catch that. I like that.
Because he only did that really against Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
Or and in some really big matches against Kawada when Kawada was starting to push him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, so the crowd senses this, starts buying into Takayama after a huge high kick, and he gets a near fall off it. Two Germans from Takayama, and yeah, it's starting to look like Takayama's got a real chance. He gets this cut on Misawa's chin, which looks awful.
Awful.
Oh, it looks like someone slashed Misawa's throat.
Yeah, it is a very weird spot to bleed from in wrestling. It's very odd. Yeah.
And then Misawa attacks the arm again, and he hits a Tiger Driver for a near fall. Takayama kind of a Tiger Driver and gets a big near fall off of Tiger Suplex, which that's actually ripping off Misawa in the match against Misawa.
Mm-hmm.
And Misawa hits some hard elbows and an Emerald Brosion, and we take it home. And this match had to make Takayama, because the way that he was treated by Misawa is, there are very few people who have ever had their limbs worked over by Misawa. Like, he's normally very much into that elbow formula. He doesn't just start working limbs on anybody.
Right. It's elbows to, you know, do the flying body press, Tiger Driver, Tiger Suplex, Emerald Flosion. So, yeah, the elbows lead to bombs, but they aren't a part of a limb psychology narrative. So that's a really cool point you brought up. I didn't connect that.
Yeah, I mean, I really thought that match made Takayama, where the Kobashi one kind of helped. It was like, hey, you know, this guy could be something. This one was like, this guy just stood in there with Misawa, and Misawa had to respect him. Like, there was no disrespect given by Misawa whatsoever in this match.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree with that 100%. Things that I would just add is, I thought there are better Misawa matches, but this is like the best like Misawa formula match, where he's just forced to work underneath and make his comeback. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I just really thought Takayama was a great opponent for Misawa, able to use his size. A couple things that I noticed, you noticed the kick that caused the bleeding. One thing that I thought was interesting was how Takayama put his hand over Misawa's mouth and started talking trash. And there's something that is deeply upsetting about having someone have their hand over your mouth. And it really incites Misawa to elbow the shit out of him. So
it's the same as a guy like putting his hand over your nose. It's like,
yeah,
you're trying to stop me from breathing.
Exactly. And so that was great. And so Takayama, comes back with the two Germans, like you said. And I love how efficient the finishing stretch is too. Really great match. To me, one of the best Misawa formula matches of all time, with Takayama just a great heel who does the little things that are different. Drawing blood, being a dick, just being huge. Also, like you said, because he's huge, Misawa has to change up his offensive strategy. So, really enjoyable match.
Absolutely. I mean, and it made Takayama a superstar in Japan for sure. After this match, he's a made man.
He is. He's freelancing in all the major promotions, making a shit ton of money. He's working domes against Nagata. He's working Budokans against Kobashi. He's winning triple crowns in all Japan. Yeah, the dude became an absolute superstar stud because of this match. All right. So my number four, again, I might be mistaken, but I don't think you've had this match yet, and I'm wondering if it's higher, maybe it's at the same position or something. It's All Japan Triple Crown Champion Genichiro Tenryu versus Keiji Muto from All Japan 6-8-2001.
Do not have that one yet. That is right around 29 or 30 for me.
Oh, okay. So you don't have it on your list at all?
Nope.
Okay. Yeah, I love this match. This match is definitely like a Marty Sleaze pick of all, you know, just I'm super high on it, probably higher than just about anybody. I just think it's just so logical. I love the plot development. I love the connective tissue between the major plot points. It's a match that's super sticky to me. When I say sticky, like I have pretty much memories of this entire match, even though I haven't watched it in 7 years. So it's just something that really stuck with me, and I just loved from a strategy standpoint. The hook, it's a dual hook match. The first hook is Muto rocks Tenryu at the start of the match with a Shining Wizard. This rings the bell of Tenryu, and Muto goes for the backbreaker. The backbreaker is always the prelude to the moonsault, but Tenryu powders before the moonsault. Credit to Tenryu. A lot of people could just sell the head rocking Shining Wizard for like a couple minutes or something. He rocks, he sells it for the entirety of the match, and it's yes, so good.
No, and, I don't dislike this match at all. I actually really like, I mean, I had it around 30, so I
was. Oh, yeah. No, I'm not. That. Yeah, I'm not. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't mean to misconstrue the situation. Being top 30 for a decade in a country is obviously high praise. I'm just saying, when I have it at number four, that I kind of know that I am like one of the highest people. Actually, in the Greatest Match Ever project, I have been the high vote on this match 2 years running. So it's not too surprising that I love or I have it so high. But Tenryu's selling of this is so great because it basically prevents him from ever stringing any offense together, especially at the beginning of the match. And so what you have is eventually Tenryu actually does get the power bomb, but it's Muto gets a like rolling capo kick to the head. And it's just like little things like that that are just so great just pull the plot together and make everything mean so much. And then from the head, we actually see the Muto transition to the knee. It's because Tenryu, in all his desperation, hits an elbow suicida. And I think similar to how you feel about Taue hitting suicide dives, when Tenryu at like, well, he's got to be at least 50 at this point, like just, you know, dives in desperation to nail somebody with a suicide dive is, you know, pops me huge.
Oh, but I love Tenryu diving. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's
like
awesome.
Anytime like a guy who doesn't normally do dives starts doing dives, it's awesome. Because generally it's like a bigger dude with a good amount of weight towards the midsection. So it's like, oh,
there's that. And it's also like always a little like it's not graceful. And I like that.
Yeah. It's rough around the edges like the rest of the match instead of them making it look really graceful.
Yeah. And so from there, that's when as they're getting back into the ring, that's when Muto does the 2001 Muto match. So Muto in 2001, very polarizing for me. I love it. A lot of people don't like the repetition. I think the repetition makes sense. Why give up? It's a full court press. There's a ton of urgency on it. And for people who don't know what the Muto 2001 strategy is, it's just wreck the knee. It's drop kicks to the knee. It's dragon leg screws. And it's figure fours. Kind of the idea is it forces the opponent to go down to one knee. And then from the one knee stance, he hits the Shining Wizard. So that's not kind of the psychology behind it. So the Shining Wizard was also introduced in 2001 as a part of the Muto Renaissance. Before 2001, before Bald Muto, there was no Shining Wizards. And he really wasn't doing this type of knee work. Anyway, so we get that going on, and there's this moment where it's awesome, and I actually read your review before this podcast, so I know you love this moment too. Tenryu starts firing back. It's a punch. It's a dragon leg screw, and then it's the ultimate fuck you drop kick to the knee. And I know at this point it's June of 2001, so Muto hadn't been doing this style for very long. But for me, after years and years of watching Muto do this to everyone, to finally see someone dropkick Muto in the knee, like, made me go absolutely insane. Like, I thought it was like the craziest spot ever. It was almost like he had hit a burning hammer. Just insert whatever crazy high spot you want to insert, and that's how I felt about the spot. But it was just a little drop kick to the knee, and it made me go nuts.
Well, what was the look on Tenryu's face afterwards? Was he looking down at Muto like Muto was basically a piece of shit that he found on the ground?
I bet he was. I don't have my review, but if there's he probably was holding him in contempt, like, you little shit, I can't believe you're doing that to me, and you deserve what you got for all your drop kicks to my knee. So then we get all the big Tenryu bombs. I love the Spider German, the top rope reverse elbow. Muto, for his point, you know, it's 2001, so it's definitely, he's getting up there in age, busts out the Frankensteiner. We see Tenryu block the Shining Wizard, get the Brain Buster, and Muta goes back to the head. He rocks the head with a bicycle kick, a shit ton of Shining Wizards. That can't get the job done. So he does he busts out the Brack Breaker and the Moonsault. The whole point of the Shining Wizard was to kind of take some pressure off of Muta's knees, because the Moonsault had fucked up his knees after all these years. But on this occasion, winning the Triple Crown for the first time, making, you know, only the third person to win both the Triple Crown and the IWGP Championship, I think he basically said, you know what, fuck it. If there was ever a time for me to hit a Moonsault, it's today. So he hits the Moonsault. It's pro wrestling love, baby. Did the Muta little signature thing there. And this is the birth of pro wrestling love, because Muta wins the Triple Crown and never leaves. He eventually stays with All Japan for like a decade, becomes their president, CEO, chairman, whatever, booker. And he spends like half his career in All Japan, even though he'll be forever associated with New Japan. So I love the match. Very logical, super fun. Every spot matters. The selling from Tenryu about the knee and the head is great. Muda's offensive strategy is immaculate. And the one thing I want to say, I know it's a little bit of a tangent, but these two have amazing chemistry together. Don't sleep on their 1996 match, which is completely different. Happens in war. It's broken glass bottles. It's tables. It's mist. It's fucking insane brawl. It's like diametrically the opposite of this match and just as good. So these two rock it together. And just an awesome match.
Yeah, I really liked it too for a lot of the reasons you did. I just didn't have it nearly rated as high.
Yeah, I think the one thing that people say, I mean, there's two camps. There's just the people who just don't like 2001 Muta, which whatever, I just disagree with them. And the other thing is, and I can kind of see it, it is a little slow. You know, they are older, so maybe it's not quite as fast as some people like.
Where the sensibility of early Shining Wizard makes sense, where
exactly
it makes it that slowness actually makes sense, where it's like, yeah, he's a little punch drunk, so he's not going to be the fastest guy in the world right now.
And that's what I always there was a couple reviews against this match, and that's the thing I always harped on, is you have to understand how critical that Shining Wizard right at the beginning of the match is. So agree with you 100%. Okay, I love that match. Love talking about it. So what's your number four, brother?
This is, in fact, my number three. So if you want to skip past me and go to your next one, that's cool. If not, we can.
Wait, I'm confused. Why don't you have a number four?
Well, I had to skip ahead because other stuff we skipped over.
You had to skip. Oh, no. Oh, I see. Wait.
I still got a couple of ones, Ishikawa versus Ikeda and Kobashi versus Takayama, that came from earlier. And then I got my top three.
I think I kind of get it. All right. I'll go ahead and say my number three. We'll make sure that we get everything, right? We'll figure it out. All right. So my number three is GHC heavyweight champion Mitsuharu Misawa versus Kenta Kobashi, Pro Wrestling Noah, March 1st, 2003.
Yeah, I don't have that one.
You don't have this one at all?
No.
Oh, wow.
I was tired of this matchup by then.
Oh, so I'm surprised. Because I thought your review was actually pretty
It was a good match. It just didn't make my top 25.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Love this match. I thought it was a very fitting conclusion to their rivalry. To me, this is the blow off to 90s All Japan and everything that they were building to. For me, 120-97 is their best match. I don't, gun to my head, oh God, I think I'd put 10-31-98 a little bit above this match, but these are the top three. 120-97, 10-31 98 and 3-1-2003. All three, I have the 5 stars. I think they're both all three are fantastic. What maybe actually put this over 10-31-98, of course, though, is that Kobashi does win. And it's not like he was passed the torch. He sees the torch, and I really enjoyed that. The future has arrived. This kicks off the magnificent Kobashi GHC title reign. That's about 2 years. Maybe a little over two. It's around 2 years, and it's just a great 2-year title reign. And I would say this is probably the most famous Japanese match of the decade, at least in America. It features two of the biggest wrestlers. It's in the Budokan. Like I said, it's sort of the blow off to everything that they were building to in the late 90s. Kobashi just would not be denied in this match. Misawa loves to fight from underneath. We see the vaunted elbow that's bailed Misawa out of so many jams. But on this night, Kobashi was just not going to be denied. Misawa begins the match by sort of going after the arm. Kind of to your point here is maybe Misawa recognizes that his time has come and gone. Kobashi's on the ascent and he needs to go after somebody's arm. So he's taking off the taking away the arm. Kobashi can't even apply a sleeper as in response to this arm work. We get a classic Misawa transition. We've seen it in a lot of the Kobashi matches, and we see it in the Nakayama match that we'll talk about soon, is that Misawa eats the guardrail, and this time it's on an elbow suicida. This opens up a really nasty gash. It's the first of many iconic spots in this match. Kobashi, similar to Akiyama, is a killer working on this neck. Misawa does this great no-sell, and we talked about this in a prior episode, and I want to point it out here again. No selling is not selling. So basically, it's not that Misawa was basically saying, okay, you finished working on my neck. I'm going to go start hitting some moves. I'm going to start hitting my little kicks, my, you know, my spin kick and my elbows and do my senton and do my flying Brian Crest. No, Misawa was registering he was in a lot of pain and he was sick and tired of having his neck beaten on. And we were basically one muscle flex away from Misawa pulling a Lex Luger. If builds so much heat. You're feeling him hulk up. You're so excited for it, and it's it just sends electricity throughout the entire building. And so it doesn't, like I say, if it doesn't matter if it's in Greensboro or Budokan, the spot is always over. But it is a clear reaction to the offense that is happening. It is not blowing off the offense. So a well-timed no sell can be just as great as a well-timed sell, is what I'm trying to say. Kobashi desperately fights off the Emerald Flosion at this point because Misawa has taken back over. He fights through a bunch of elbows to hit his lariat. At this point, Misawa suplexes him on the apron. And this begins pretty much the most famous sequence of the match. Misawa elbows Kobashi through the ropes onto the apron. And at 25 minutes, I'm wondering what's going through their mind at this point, knowing what's going to happen next. And they're lying on the ramp together. And in the spot of the match, very famous, Misawa tiger suplexes Kobashi off the ramp onto the floor. And they do a great job. I think maybe I'll do a podcast series where I go through the Kobashi Misawa matches in chronological order. But one of the elements that was super consistent in all their matches was how important moves off the apron were in determining the winner of the match. I think what's really interesting about this is typically Misawa would land the move off the apron. Kobashi would be valiant, defiant, but ultimately succumb to Misawa. The fact that Misawa was able to tiger suplex him off the ramp, up the ante, this is the most insane high spot off. It's even bigger than off the apron. And Kobashi comes back and wins. I'm just realizing this now as I'm talking through it, was clearly an important booking device to show how much Kobashi was not going to be denied on this night. That Kobashi was going to overcome all the odds to win, and they were really stacking the deck against him. Crowd's totally jacked to the moon. They're selling the attrition really well. Obviously, they tease a double count out. The double count out tease is so good. We get the classic Misawa back elbows, the Emerald Flosion, 1-2, no. Huge pop for this near fall. It's crazy. We get a delayed brainbuster from Kobashi. There's Misawa chance, not because the crowd doesn't want Kobashi not to win. It's because they don't want the match to end. They're just having such a great time. The match is so epic. We get the burning hammer finish. It's terrific. It's well worth the wait. Sometimes when you play the waiting game, you miss your mark, like with the Kawada victory over Misawa not being as hot as it could have been if it had been done earlier, or there's injuries or people leave the promotion. Sometimes you just never get to do it. We are very fortunate that after you know, 8 years in the making, even longer, really, if you include their tag team run together, that they were able to execute the match and also just deliver a real banger. So epic match. Love this match. Good shit from both of these guys.
Nothing wrong with the match. It's just not my style of match. Like, I don't like the way Noah turned the All Japan Epic into more of an epic.
It's just, yep, it's totally
a little overdone for me. I'm not taking anything away from anything these guys did, because one, it probably just destroyed them physically. One, and two, it was really great wrestling. It just went away from what I wanted, so why I don't have it as high.
I think I would only allow this for these two men. Maybe a few others, but these two men in particular, I'm letting them go there. There's a reason why I don't have a lot of Noah matches from the back half of the decade, from 2005 to 2009. A lot of them were overcooked, as I would say. And I think that's what you're trying to get at here. It's a little overcooked.
Yeah, too much laying around after big spots to make it more epic. And
I can understand where you're coming from. I have a lot of the same quibbles with the back half of the decade from Noah. All right, man. I'm a little confused about your countdown.
I think I figured it out.
Okay.
At some point, one of us called out Ishikawa versus Ikeda, and I pulled it out as one that we both had. And I think that was my six, and I ended up skipping that.
Got it. All right. So Ishikawa,
I can't remember what number it was, but one of us, or I think you had it earlier than I did, and I pulled it out, and I didn't put it back into order here. So
I see. All right, Ishikawa Ikeda was my 17. It's your 6. We'll backtrack a little bit here. Talk to me about it. What's your what's your take on it?
April 24th of 2005. Ishikawa or Ikeda, right at the bell as the ref is still checking over Ishikawa, punches Ishikawa in the face.
Right? Yes.
Not worked punch. He punches him in the face.
Yes.
I would guess it's more of like a sparring punch, where it's like when you spar with someone who isn't sort of the same class discipline as you are, like you'll punch hard enough that it hurts and they don't want to take it again, so they block it if they leave themselves open. And I'm guessing that's kind of what they were going for here. Even so, ow. Anyway, Ishikawa, after a brawl, he takes advantage of a position and gets a Kimura on Ikeda, and then they do a really good grappling sequence. Probably not their best ever, but they do a really good sequence. Ishikawa gets knocked down. He's in a big hole because he's been knocked down twice, and Ikeda really hasn't been. He's just been exchanging holds with him on the mat. Ikeda gets a leg submission reversed, and it's really good because the ref is trying to get him to break the hold. And while he's not breaking the hold, Ishikawa is working his way into getting that same leg submission on him. So he just goes panicky for the rope because Ishikawa's really got it on good because he was focusing on keeping the ref off himself, which was just a great spot. And then they just start hitting each other really, really hard. And I'm not probably selling this as well as I should, because these are absolutely brutal shots. I mean, not many people hit each other this hard in a wrestling ring.
I agree.
And I think they start doing grappling when they need their head to clear a little bit, personally. Just because I can't see taking the kind of punishment they're dishing out back and forth over and over again like that. And then Ikeda hits some absolutely brutal punt kicks on the ground after he knocks Ishikawa down. God, I hate the Ikeda Ishikawa thing. I want to say one or the other. Anyway, but he'll get a knockdown on Ishikawa, and when Ishikawa looks like he's getting up, he'll just run up and punt him in the face. It's evil. Ishikawa gets some suplexes. It's a big jump high kick. Then they go to some frantic grappling, and Ishikawa gets a chicken wing crossface and gets the win. And, this match is just absolutely brutal. There is a story to it. There is, and it's not bad. The grappling is good. But the thing I always took away from it was these two guys really like punching each other in the face.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. So I actually talked about this match with Marco Mountain Matt in a previous episode when we were doing the best shoot style as a genre. And just to set the table for people in case they may have not heard that, this is taking place in Futen, which is basically Battle Arts, but run by Daisuke Ikeda. Battle Arts is run by Yuki Ishikawa. Both men are students of Yoshiaki Fujiwara. And basically how it works out is this is the Tom and Jerry of pro wrestling. They will be forever linked. They wrestled as recently as last year in Germany. And their style is to hit each other as fucking hard as possible. No one knows why they hate each other. They just do. And basically the way I put it is after the nuclear winter, there will be cockroaches, Keith Richards, and Ishikawa Nakeda beating the shit out of each other. So
absolutely they will.
If there's one thing that will survive anything, it's their hatred. So I love these guys. What's interesting you brought up, and me and Marco Mountain Matt kind of had a similar discussion about was, you know, does this, you know, why we like this match. And there is a story to it, but it's just so, like, the punches are so hard that, like, it's what really jumps out to you is just how ultra violent this match is.
Yeah, they don't look like worked punches.
No, there's one punch where Ishikawa punches Ikeda right in the face on the ground. And me and Matt both talked about it. You just couldn't believe the force of this punch. And there was no place for Ikeda's head to absorb it because his head was right on the ground. So his face just took the full brunt of this punch. And it was insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. The way they're hitting each other, they have to grapple in between or else there'd be a knockout and the match would be over.
Yeah. And I will say this was more punch heavy than some of their other matches from like the late 90s in Battle Arts. Typically, the style is that Ikeda is the striker, kickboxer, a lot of kicks, whereas Ishikawa is the wrestler. And like I said, there is a little bit of a story because Ishikawa tends to come from behind. He likes to work underneath. So at the beginning of the match, I counted this. There is no point system in Futen. Ikeda gets 4 knockdowns and forces 2 rope breaks, whereas Ishikawa only has 1 knockdown and 2 rope breaks at the front half of the match. Ishikawa ends up making a big comeback, closes the gap, garnering 5 knockdowns, and it's 3-3 on rope breaks. And the point of that is to show that there is a narrative to it. Like, Ikeda was winning if you just count on points, and Ishikawa does make the comeback. And like you said, the finish run is just insane. Ishikawa's face is just getting destroyed. He's bleeding profusely from the mouth. We get the suplexes and the cross face chicken wing submission was just the cherry on top of this sundae. Awesome match. So,
yep. And then do you want to go to my number 3 then or no?
Yes, let's do your – so we're back on track now.
Yep.
All right, let's go.
My number 3 is in the same vein. Okay. It is Ishikawa, Atsuka, and Sawa against Ikeda, Super Tiger, and Usuda from July 26th of 08.
Okay.
And this one I don't want to talk a lot about because I think it would ruin the match for people.
And we actually talked about this one in our Shoot Style podcast a couple episodes ago. I mean, I still want to get your take on, you know,
I don't want to do anything about the eliminations, though, because I think that, you know what I mean? Like, that makes the story of the match, and it's a great story to go along with the still ridiculous stiffness.
Yes, I agree. So go ahead and talk about what you want to talk about. I'll chime in a little bit afterwards, but I agree with you. I think there's something to be said about just watching this match unfold in real time.
I mean, this is one you have to experience just because the absolute brutality of trying to put a submission on somebody. Anyway, so we open up and we establish all the major themes. Sawa really wants to prove himself against Ikeda. Ikeda's team is the heels. They're more willing to triple team, double team, cheat, whatever it may be. So then, as a result of that, Atsuka puts on this slick double submission where he catches a kick while he's got like a one-handed submission on another guy. So he's got two guys in different submissions at the same time because he's Otacon. He can do that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the early match does not really set the right expectation for the late match, which I kind of like. Because it's really tame. You know what I mean? It's really tame. Like, they're just working through stuff. They're not really doing a lot of the stiffness. They're just doing some mat work. It's really good mat work. It's just, it's not what it's going to become.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At one point, Ikeda does tease a punt when Sawa's down, but Sawa sees it coming and pops up to his feet and is like, oh, well, I'm not going to take that. So what really happens is, the first elimination I will do is Sawa stays in way too long. He has four or five chances to tag out.
Yep.
But he wants to prove himself. He's just like, hey, I'm the young guy here. I'm going to get one of these guys. And he doesn't. He ends up tapping out. And that just sets up this three-on-two nightmare for Otsuka and Ishikawa, mm-hmm. where they are just in a hole. And whenever anybody puts on a submission on them,
yep.
they can't make it over to help. Mm-hmm. But if they put a submission on somebody else, there's an extra guy coming in to just kick them in the face or stomp them. And these aren't, like, nice kicks to the face. These are – I'm struggling to describe them other than – you just see the guy walking into the ring and you're like, oh, God, please don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, with anything Battle Arts, Futen, these guys, it's just ultra-violent is the way I
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you just know there's going to be pain once either Otsuka or Ishikawa puts on a submission because they're a man down, and it's just so easy for a guy to stroll over as somebody else is holding off the one guy who can come in and stop them and just do whatever they want. And it's just wrong. And there is a spot late in the match where there's a submission. It's kind of like it's like an Indian deathlock kind of thing. And the guy putting it on just dares the person who's on the apron to hit him out of it and ends up getting kicked deeper into the submission each time.
Yes,
I love that spot. It is amazing. And yes, it hurts him. And then stretch arm when it finally gets back to one-on-one. Oh, that's just mean.
Yes, for sure.
And yeah, that's all I'm gonna say, because like after that Sawa elimination, this match just gets to be amazing. Like up until then, it's really good. Like you can see the story starting to develop and what's going to happen, but after that it just gets turned up to 11.
Yeah, so I think the things that I'll bring up, and you know, it's great that you brought up a lot of the same things as me, and I that's good that we're reinforcing stuff. The one thing I will say, I just want to make sure I get them in the correct order. I like that you brought up Sawa, and how much he really wanted to prove himself, and how he was obsessed with trying to beat Ikeda and his team, and it just doesn't go well for him. I think the other thing that was super important, what really makes this match special, that you don't see in Survivor Series elimination matches, even though you could, is the disadvantage of being a man down. And so in a match where you can only win by either knock or eliminate somebody by knockout or submission, you basically effectively take submission away from somebody by the fact that, like you said, they had an extra man advantage, so they can break up your submissions at will. Now they get around this in a really cool way with how you said, like the really fun. I love that spot where he kicks him so hard, it wrenches the hold even more, and so. There's great stuff like that that really plays off that narrative. So I really think without getting into a full match review, that element, that strategic element, that tactical element really makes this match great. One thing I also want to say is did not make my list because of diversity. I kind of knew you were going to have it on there. I do like the tag team Battle Arts match that I picked. higher, but this would be something that makes my top 25. It's just I wanted to talk about more matches, so I kind of left it off. But this is this is something that is truly, if I was to rate this like in a very fair way, would make my top 12 or so. Love this match a lot.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing match.
Yeah. All right, so on to my number two, brother. We're in the home stretch. This is the silver medal position for me. You've talked – I think you mentioned this one already. So it's the GHC heavyweight champion Kenta Kobashi versus Yoshihiro Takayama from Pro Wrestling NOAH in the Budokan, April 25th, 2004.
Yeah, love this match too.
Yeah, this match. So going into this project, from my limited 21st century Japanese watching, I thought this was going to be my pick for the best match. Ended up finishing number two, which I think is a testament to how great this match is. But yeah, falls short of number one. So this is Kobashi's kind of to set the table. Kobashi beat Misawa 3-1 2003. We just talked about it. He has the matches with Honda that you talked about. He had a match with Ogawa that we both talked about at the end of November. At the end of 2003. So we're going into the second year as champion. And to me, this is sort of his biggest match since winning the title. This is his biggest challenge. He'll go on to face Akiyama in the Dome later on in the summer, but this was a big deal. Takayama is both bigger. He's got shoot credentials. He's a former GHC and IWGP champion. And Kobashi can't just sort of bullhead power his way out of this. He kind of has to be a little bit smarter to try to win this match. I felt like, and I want to see if you agree with me, I felt like he kind of Kobashi sort of treated Takayama like he would treat Stan Hansen. A lot of big bombs early, and the mentality being a great offense is a good defense. Did you kind of get that feel that he was going up against like a Hansen when the way he wrestled Takayama?
It was definitely different. He treated him different than he would a lot of people, and I really like. He didn't go into full-on chop mode. Which I really liked. And one thing I really liked is he played off of that 2000 match where while the ref was checking him, he did not take his eyes off of Takayama for a second.
I didn't even notice that detail. That's a really good point because Takayama did attack him at the opening bell in 2000.
Before,
good catch.
Just while the ref was doing like the, okay, check the boots. Like while the ref was down there, like in the 2000 match, Kobashi was looking down and looks up and there's a head kick, and that's what got Takayama off to his fast start. So this time he nothing doing.
Good catch. Nice, neat, nice detail. So to me, the match sort of changes a little bit of complexion when Takayama hits one of those massive knee lifts. You know, he just hits right through Kobashi. Kobashi had been a little overzealous at this point, charging too much. And what I like is Kobashi actually reacts to this and takes back control, but he scales back his offense. He's working holds a little bit more. He's being a little bit more conservative, with the idea being, if I can work the headlock or what have you, work a hold, I can set up my bomb offense later on. But the thing is, they're putting over Takayama's size as to that Kobashi has to wear him down before he can hit the big bombs. But when he does go for the delayed vertical suplex, he goes for it too early. This leads to the Takayama guillotine choke. So Takayama flips the script. He starts working a little bit more conservative, but it's to set up the kick and knee lift game. He gets a nice knee lift butterfly suplex combination. And what I love about this match is the original intent was for Takayama to actually go after the knees. You know, both heavily braced like Ogawa went after. Kobashi knows that his knees are weak and really tries to avoid this by going for his trusty chop. And Takayama just takes the arm and just snaps the arm over his own shoulder. And it's bye-bye arm at that point. And what I think is that it just really shows the adaptability of Takayama. He wasn't stubborn. He just wanted a limb. He wanted a weakness. I understand why you would go for the knees originally. A lot of knee injuries, a lot of knee surgery. They're heavily braced. It's an obvious weak point. But
and
he just
can leg kick from a little farther away than chop range.
Right. But he takes what the match gives him. So right. Kobashi gives him his arm, so he takes the arm and just ruins it. And I love that I think that's really just great wrestling. So Takayama, to me, the iconic spot of the match, well, there's two. The finish is iconic, but the iconic spot in the middle of the match is Takayama hits a monster German suplex off the apron, which is a classic All Japan Noah trope, right? It's the big move, big suplex, big slam off the apron.
It's just Takayama's using his.
Exactly. And it's pretty insane, you know. I mean, a German suplex.
Way that he landed off of that.
Yeah.
That was not okay. He didn't have to bump like that for it. It was off the apron. He could have just taken a flatter bump.
Yeah, it was, and both men just looked absolutely worse for wear after that one. So then Kobashi starts rocking and rolling. It's a lot of, you know, the spinning back chops, half Nelson suplexes. And Takayama makes his last stand using nasty punches. Again, it's that thing that started with Kawada way back when things aren't going your way and you're the bad guy, you get frustrated, you start going to the closed fist. And we end up getting Kobashi hitting the half Nelson suplex, the brain buster. He wants the burning hammer, but his arm can't handle it. And I love this. So Takayama throws a wild kick. We get the burning lariat. Still can only get two because his arm's messed up. Kobashi has this bloody lip, a crazed look in his eyes. And for the first time, I want to say, during this title reign and since he had knee surgery, he signals for the moonsault. And it's that crazed look like, I don't give a fuck that my knees are going to feel like shit for like a month when I land. I'm going for it. Crowd goes nuts. I remember going nuts. And he moonsaults Takayama right on his fucking face. So, awesome finish. To me, this combines David versus Goliath, excellent limb psychology, and 90s All Japan into one awesome package.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. They really worked all that stuff you talked about. They did a really great cross-arm breaker spot in there.
Yep, that's true, too. Yep.
There was a knee counter to a diving shoulder, which I love that his knees, when they're countering a high-flying move. Oh, wow, that looks awful.
Yeah.
Takayama actually stole the half Nelson this match. He did a half Nelson to Kobashi.
Okay. I missed that detail.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Yeah.
No one does that.
Yeah. It is the audacity of it.
Yeah, and that moonsault, just the reaction was just like, yeah, that... You deserve that reaction for that, because the way the match worked up to that just said, yeah, if you're going to win, it has to be with something without the arm. So there it was.
I love it. Couldn't do the burning hammer. I mean, in a lot of ways, the burning hammer was invented to sort of – I mean, the moonsault wasn't quite as big as the burning hammer, but the idea is my knees are fucked. I can't keep moonsaulting. It's very similar to Muda's knees, right? But
that
now,
and the lariat and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so – yeah, the burning lariat really was another one that kind of replaced the moonsault. But in this case, he just couldn't use his arm, so he had to go for the moonsault, even though he knows his knees are all messed up. So I loved it so much.
Yeah, I had it ranked pretty high, too. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's good. It's good stuff for sure. All right, what is your silver medalist match?
Kenta Kobashi versus Akira Taue, September 10th of 04.
Ah, another match from this magnificent title reign. It's our love letter to Kenta Kobashi. So go ahead, my man.
I'd write one of those.
It's Valentine's Day. I wish Kobashi was my Valentine. So... what's going on? What do you love about this match? I had it a little bit further down in my teens, so why don't you take it away since you got it number two?
So early on, Taue does one of his overhand chops, and he gets a chop back from Kobashi and immediately backs off, which is awesome. And he goes to a headlock after that instead of trying to strike with him, because why would you do that? So then he starts it again, lets Kobashi get a couple of chops in, then hits a rolling chop, like the spinning chop that Kobashi does, and then the Taue Tope, which is just like, you did the spinning chop on Kobashi? What's going on here? Which kind of sets a tone. And then he goes back to that early match offense that's very Taue, where it's really kind of grindy and like he just punched a clock and he's here to, you know, wear a guy down real slow and steady. He'll do the drops over the rope, the drops over the railing, just work holds, just work his stuff. And then when Kobashi comes back, it's this explosive stuff. Like, he hits a flying shoulder to come back, which to me is a great kind of counterpoint to the way that he had been getting assaulted. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. Yep.
And so then he chops him out of the ring. He hits a pescado, crossbody jumping out of the ring. Then he does that thing that I've always loved about Kobashi, where he'll run a guy into the ropes, hit a knee, run all the way back across the ring with the guy, knee him again, then back into a Russian leg sweep. That is just, no one stole that spot ever, and I don't understand why not.
I know, that should definitely make its way into America.
Because that is, how do you not love that spot? Anyway. And then he does that work he used to do in the 90s on the mat, where, like, he'll do submissions, Kobashi will, but then as he feels the guy starting to wiggle out, he'll adjust to a different submission for the same limb. Like, he won't just sit in that submission, wait for the guy to get to the ropes, and go, oh, well, okay, and I'll move a little bit and put this submission on.
Right.
Instead of, and that is, I've always loved that. It's like, he has this work rate mentality of everything, where, like, I can't just sit too long. If it's not working, I got to start doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
So then they actually did do a longer chop exchange, which definitely did not work in Taue's favor and is probably the reason that he lost the match. I mean, it's the one flaw I have in this match. Then they go to an abdominal stretch. Taue, using that, the kneeling figure four, or the prison lock, as mm-hmm. it's called, is absolute genius. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
He's been working the leg. And so when he goes to that, he gives Kobashi, he's feeding him the comeback already. Because he's within reach of Kobashi's arms. So Kobashi can kind of sit up a little and chop him.
Mm-hmm.
So Kobashi does that and then goes into that Akiyama front choke.
Yep.
Or front neck lock or whatever you want to call it. And then not only that, but Taue and Kobashi both were thinking so far ahead here that they're right back up against the apron. Or not the apron, but the ramp. Mm-hmm. So as soon as they get out of this submission, they go into the ramp. So then when that whole ramp section comes, it's not like running around, like working to it. They're right there.
Right.
So then they do their ramp thing and it leads to an apron nodawa after what I really liked about this apron nodawa for Taue was that he wanted it at first, but Kobashi is fighting it. So he takes a couple of those chops, throws some back, and then Kobashi opens him up for that sort of enziguri type thing he does on the apron, and then he gets the backdrop nodawa off the apron instead.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, he was patient, he didn't force it, he was going to get something out of it, he has just had to work his way to it and take some punishment to get there.
Exactly, yeah, I agree with that.
So then we get through all that, and Kobashi's dead because he just took, like, the big nodawa off the apron, not the regular one that he could have had right away. And mm-hmm. Taue, he's not going to take the count-out win. He's going to go out after him.
Yep. And
Kobashi does hit a lariat counter, but he's so dead that he can't capitalize on it. It's the only spot in this match where both guys are just laying on their back for a while. And then they go into this huge finishing sequence that I've already detailed before, and I don't want to do it again because I don't think I'd do it as good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Taue hits a Rana in there. Kobashi hits a Nadawa. A moonsault misses. I mean, there's they don't go back to it afterwards. Taue does an inside cradle as a hope spot after Kobashi has cut him off for the last time. And this is less than a minute after he had been dominating Kobashi. But Kobashi comes back and then Taue goes into an inside cradle. That's it's just ridiculous.
Yes. Very smart. Yeah. Late in the match to you know, just go for the win.
Yeah. And then, yeah. So after the match, they shake hands after Kobashi wins with the burning hammer. And yeah, just great, great match. Just, I love the differences between them early match and how they highlighted them. I love pretty much everything about the match except for that one strike exchange.
I'm not surprised that you like this match a lot. To me, this is a total 90s All Japan classic. It's not as overwrought.
Yeah, it's like Taue never really got with the times. He was like, you know what, we're going to do this the old way.
Yeah, Taue was definitely stuck in the 90s, and it definitely helped this match.
Yeah, and just so much of it made sense for where they were and what they were trying to do at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it also speaks to Taue being the king of efficiency and all that. I think you did a great job going over the match. I think I'm just going to say like a couple quick things. One is just keep reinforcing and reiterating that Taue was really fucking over at this point. Yeah. And I actually felt bad for the fans. They wanted him to win so badly. So I'm glad that Taue won the next year. I remember his win over Rikkyo. Like I for some reason, I feel like I remember the fans like celebrating with him. Like he was just not like celebrating in the stand. Like I remember either the fans were in the ringside area. I don't know. Maybe I'm just like inflating my own memory, but they were just so pumped when he beat Rikkyo for that title the following year. So Taue was super over. This is an underrated combination of the four corners, five pillars. Great matches in 95 and 98. So don't sleep on this matchup. Really like their Champions Carnival match in 95 and their the Triple Crown title defense in 98. So
well, definitely check. To your point that you had made two or three shows ago,
okay,
where Kawada and Kobashi was not a great matchup because they tended to bring out the worst in each other.
Yeah.
Whereas this matchup, Taue could always kind of take the extraneous stuff that Kobashi liked to do and sort of say, okay, well, we'll fit that in here and here where it makes sense, but we're going to try and do this in a way that is a little more efficient.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Taue is a great editor to have in your match. He kind of he puts the where all the moves are together. So really well.
Yeah.
All right, man. It's time for the gold medal. I know that we both have the same match at number one. So you can go ahead and announce it and go first because you're the guest. So I'd rather you go first. You get the floor. Talk about it, and I'll chime in afterwards. We both agree. What is the undisputed best a pro wrestling match to take place in Japan between 2000 and 2009?
This is Jun Akiyama versus Mitsuhiro Misawa, February 27th of 2000.
All right, man. It is indeed awesome. Talk to us about it.
So they have this really great strike exchange, and Misawa ends up hitting that fake-out dive to the apron elbow. Which, I mean, I've always loved that. That's just an awesome spot. And he uses all his early match offense, the missile drop kick, the lariat, the senton. I don't think he hit the running crossbody, but everything else.
Mm-hmm.
He uses elbows. He's in control. And then he does a chin lock, which you might think you'd complain about it, but he's the veteran here. You know, he's up against a younger guy who's probably a little more energetic. And so he's just slowing it down and making sure he takes his time. And then Akiyama counters that Misawa move that always gets countered in big matches, that run into the corner, then jump back into either a reverse headbutt or elbow. And Akiyama just takes it and he spikes Misawa's head into the ground. And he turns the advantage around on him then. And then he really attacks the neck. He goes outside, uses the rail, uses the apron, hits an exploder off the apron. And Misawa, when he takes that apron exploder, it's a really weird landing where he lands just his head on the apron and then rolls over off to the floor, which looks awful. So then Akiyama, he's on the neck, just he is super efficient on the neck. He doesn't in any way come off it, and he does this weird kind of sideways cravat variant that I've never seen before. Looks painful as hell.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, his neck work was so good in this match.
And Misawa hits a back elbow after backing him into the corner, and it is, as you say, about that other back elbow he threw. Yeah, it's just mean. Like, he gets the rope break and then just goes to town with that back elbow. And
yeah,
because he has been worked over so much, he goes to the face lock right away, which puts over the fact that Akiyama might be onto something here. He's really hurting him. So then, you know, he knows he needs to do a lot of damage, and he's really working that face lock. Akiyama counters, Misawa going up top. He hits a drop kick, and then he hits that one knee out to the outside off the apron, and then drapes Misawa over the guardrail and jumps off the apron with a knee, which is just nasty looking.
Mm-hmm.
It's, oh, wow. I don't really know. You'd have to watch the match to really see how awful this looks. I don't know how that didn't suck.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, all this neck work is just absolutely, it's laser focused. It's just awesome work from Akiyama on top.
Oh, yeah. And then he reels off some near falls, and the crowd is starting to believe he has a chance, which is crazy because he's never had a chance before. And then Misawa comes back. Akiyama's resisting, but Misawa's Misawa. He gets a couple tiger drivers. He's got a suplex in there. He's hitting some elbows. And after he kicks out of that second tiger driver, you know that Akiyama is in a place where he's never been before.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't survived that long before. He hasn't done this much damage before. How's he going to react? So he takes a rolling elbow and pops up and hits an exploder. And then Misawa pops up after that, but there's another exploder waiting for him. And Misawa does a failed no-sell where he pops up and falls right back over, which just, I mean, it takes that tension of, okay, Akiyama's done a lot more damage than normal, and Misawa has hit him with his big stuff, and it's not done yet. All he's got left is the frozen. So It's like, then once you put in this no-sell after the second exploder, it's all of a sudden, it's like, holy shit, Akiyama actually has a chance here.
Yep.
Like, it just drives that entire thing home. You know what I mean? It's like, it takes the rest of the match and says, okay, all that's real. Because against Misawa, that's never really the case until you reach a certain point.
Yep.
So it just drives that home just so pointedly. And then, yeah, Misawa kicks out of a couple other things, and Akiyama is not having it. He just hits that wrist clutch exploder. 1, 2, 3. He's beaten Misawa, which I think he's the fastest guy to beat Misawa, too.
Yeah. I mean, it was a non-title situation. I wasn't Champions Carnival either. I mean, I know it took quite a while. I don't actually know when was Kobashi's first pinfall of Misawa? It wasn't 2003, I don't think, right?
No, I don't remember. But yeah, it seemed like just from him being in the main events in 95 to in 2000 getting it was pretty quick.
Oh, I agree with that. Yeah, Akiyama is pretty fast. I just don't know for sure. But yeah, it's interesting because this doesn't take place with the Triple Crown on the line, nor is it at the Champions Carnival. So it's kind of an interesting, I think the main event of the show was Kobashi versus Vader with the Triple Crown on the line, but which was also a great match. I mean, this match clearly was a lot better, but awesome show to go to if you happened to be at the Budokan that night. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the match that, in my opinion, really feels like it was going to kick off Akiyama's big rise to the top. And you see it later on in the year in Noah, the first show he turns on Kobashi, second show he chokes Kobashi out and they have to stretcher Kobashi out. You really felt like Akiyama was going to be the biggest star of the decade. And sort of like how you talked about how Misawa made Takayama in 2001. This feels like it should have had the same effect, and it did for like a couple years, but then booking kind of eroded this match. But the match on its own is a standalone classic. to me, this is the perfect blend of work rate and storytelling. The layout, yes. Timing of all the spots, maximum effect, they all make sense. They're all done with urgency and force. To me, what they did was visually pleasing. How they did it was urgently and forceful. It made you engrossed to watch it. When they did it, all made sense. And the story underpinning all this action was very satisfying. So I think it just hits on every point. Just some quick things, because you did a great job breaking down everything. So to me, the moment where the match goes from great to classic is the drop toe hold onto the railing. Just what a wicked drop toe hold. The way Misawa sold, the way he's just hanging there, the way Akiyama hits a knee right after that, and then just the pile driver on the floor, the wrist clutch exploder on the apron. Like, it's just a insane offensive onslaught from Akiyama, all stemming from that drop toe hold on the railing. So great spot and great follow through by Akiyama. From Misawa, it's the he can take a licking but keep on ticking. It's classic Misawa fighting from underneath. You talked about that absolute monster back elbow. I note that also. In addition to that, the knee drop that just crushes Akiyama's nose was insane. So just a lot of great stuff. I can picture Akiyama doing the diving top elbow to the neck.
Oh, I love that elbow. It's just yes. Such a – I don't know if that was the first time he'd used it in a match. I'd have to go back and look, but it's the first time he used it to such effect.
To such effect. And I think he – after this match, he would become a person who liked to work the neck of his opponents. So I think it got used more often. And the one thing I wanted to point out, and I was wondering if you were going to point it out, but you didn't, is so you talked about the two exploders and how on the second exploder, Misawa does the failed no-sell. What I thought that was Misawa fumbling around, looking a lot like arch rival Toshiaki Kawada.
It is. Yeah.
And I think what he was signaling to the offense was he was finally the Kawada in the situation. That he was defiant, he was fumbling, flailing around, but ultimately he was going to succumb. And so you see that. Akiyama has to hit like a zillion more moves to win. It's like a running knee, an exploder, a wrist clutch exploder, a brain buster. But that was the moment where it's like you said, oh shit, the kid's going to do it. The kid's going to pull it off.
Right, because before then, it's like, Misawa makes his comeback, and you're like, oh, we've seen this a bunch of times.
I've heard this song before, is basically right. What he's saying.
So yep. It's like, okay, after that second Tiger Arrow, what's Akiyama going to do? How is this going to play out? Because that's the critical moment. Because it's like, yep. Okay, he just powered through that second one, kicked out. Can he come back from this? Because that's where Kawada always got tripped up. That's where Kobashi always got tripped up. What is Akiyama going to do?
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that 100%. And Akiyama hit a home run, you know, in the face of the greatest comeback artist in the history of comebacks, with the elbow rattling him, he came back and hit the two exploders and he took it home. So what a finish. To me, great story. You know, the young lion finally dethroning the Warrior King. Great work on the neck. And like I said, and also just one of the best offensive spectacles of all time. You know, if you love offense, really highly recommend this match.
Yeah, and all of it was earned, too. It wasn't like, yes. Even though Misawa was hurt, he wasn't just taking it. He had to fight for it. It's just he did.
Exactly. Akiyama was fighting through, like we said, the back elbow, that knee drop that basically crushed Akiyama's nose. Akiyama was in a dogfight, and he really did earn it. He could have succumbed at any moment to the legend of Misawa and Misawa's elbow and Misawa's Tiger Drivers.
Absolutely, and he didn't. He just fought through it, and he got there, which, I mean, they should have used it more after that whole sequence in Noah right away, but they didn't. So yeah. I don't know. But, I mean, like I said earlier, maybe that's good for his career that he wasn't in all those neck-busting matches.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, at least for his own personal health. And he still had a great career. It's just, you know, what you think is he could have been, you know, the guy after Kobashi to lead Noah into the 2010s, but, you know, fate had a different role for him to play, and he still had great matches and a great career, of course. All right, my man. It is that's it. That's the top 25. We agreed on number one, so because the two of us agreed, it's undisputed at this point. The greatest Japanese wrestling match to happen in the 2000s was Jun Akiyama versus Mitsuharu Misawa, All Japan Pro Wrestling, February 27th, 2000, in the Budokan. All right, brother, is there anything you want to say to the people? You've been on for 5 episodes now. How was your experience on the Pro Wrestling Love Show?
It was awesome. I got to talk about some of the best wrestling of the 2000s.
Yeah, man. I thank you so much for coming on, taking time out of your days to talk to me. I've really enjoyed it. I've learned a lot from you. Keep on reviewing, please, at prowrestlingonly.com. If you have time, join the gweproject.freeforums.net to vote for the greatest wrestling match ever. We do it every year. But I really appreciate you keeping me company. I think if people go to the Pro Wrestling Only forums, as you've probably noticed too, there's a lot of times my post is like the only post in the match thread. So thank you for keeping me company all these years. I think we've known each other for like 7 or 8 years now. So I really appreciate that. And, you know, as the show progresses and as you progress in your yearbook watching, definitely be willing to have you back on again, brother. Real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about, let me know.
All right, brother. So from Mike to Who 5 on Pro Wrestling Only, we're signing off. It's been another great 5-episode series. We counted down the top 25 greatest matches to take place in Japan between the years 2000 and 2009. I hope everybody stays safe. Take care of each other. And I hope you guys join us next week.